Good morning to you, sir. You are Mr. Pohlmeier. You may approach, and you may proceed.
As I mentioned, my name is Brock Pohlmeier. I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Tina Eshelman. Briefly, factually, Tina Eshelman is the biological aunt of Joseph C. This appeal is taken from the juvenile court of Lincoln County from a placement hearing where the appellant sought to have, or HHS rather, sought to have placement with the appellant, the state, and the guardian ad litem, or sought to have placement with foster care. The court erred in this case in two material respects. First, they failed in finding that the state and the department made reasonable efforts to reunify Joseph with his biological family after it was determined that placement with his parents was not feasible. Second, the court erred in finding that the state and the guardian ad litem met their burden of proof sufficient to overcome the preference for familial placement when they decided to keep Joseph with foster placement. As you're aware, Nebraska law requires reasonable efforts to be made to reunify families after a juvenile is placed in home care. And when reunification with a parent is not feasible, a juvenile court is required to give preference to relatives as a placement resource when considering permanency. Unfortunately, the record in this case is absolutely clear that reasonable efforts were not made to reunify Joseph with his kin. And just to reiterate the fact, Joseph was placed with foster placement in June 18 of 2016 after placement with his maternal relatives failed. 12 days later, and this was about a year after the proceedings had been initiated, Tina Eshelman, the appellant, was first located by family findings. She had no idea of Joseph's existence. He was a child born to an affair of her brother. And immediately upon being notified, she indicated her intent that she was willing and able to provide permanency for Joseph and to adopt him. Notwithstanding her stated ability and willingness, the department moved very slowly in allowing any contact with Tina. They waited 6 months from her being notified to provide a letter to Joseph that introduced Tina to him and the rest of her family, to introduce herself and to state to him their willingness to become involved in his life and to provide him permanency. It was 8 months after she was initially located that the department finally allowed in-person visitation. After that, she was only allowed 10 visits. She was scheduled to have overnight visitation, and that was subsequently denied. She was not able to interact with Joseph in the home. She was forced to travel from Wyoming to North Platte to have visitation in controlled settings with him. And she was denied any opportunity whatsoever to form a bond and to become the adoptive parent of Joseph.
What should the department have done?
I think the department should have allowed visitation to proceed much more rapidly. Joseph had PTSD and he had some bad behavioral issues. He was in a very brief placement with his grandparents, which shouldn't have happened to begin with. They didn't even have their own home. They were couch surfing, essentially. And he was then placed with maternal relatives that ended up deciding that they couldn't provide him permanency. They placed Joseph with foster care on June 18th, and 12 days later found the Eshelman. Instead of allowing for visitation to occur early and often, they delayed it, didn't allow in-person contact for 6 months, which allowed him to foster his relationship with his temporary placement in foster care.
And your client had no relationship with Joseph before being placed in this foster care?
She didn't know that he existed. And so on June 30th of 2016, when she's informed of his existence, she immediately voices her willingness to provide permanency for him. She is experienced foster parent. Her family has provided permanency for other children, and when she found that she had blood kin that she was unaware of that needed a home, she immediately voiced her intent to provide adoption. So the department should have facilitated that. And it's bizarre because ultimately the department's position was that he should be placed with the appellant. But based on the recommendations of his counselor, they continued to defer to her and drag this out for 6 to 8 months and didn't allow for any true bonding to occur. That's not to say that he didn't have a relationship with the appellant. From all indications, their visits went very well. He asked when he was going to be able to go home with them, said that he loved Tina Eshelman and her family and wanted to live with them. He was unfortunately not given the opportunity to do so because of the progression of this case and the way that the department handled it.
So your client didn't intervene, correct?
Did not.
What is your strongest argument that your client has standing to take this appeal?
I believe it is conferred upon her by the juvenile code, specifically 43-246-5, tells the department they have to consider relatives as preferred potential placement resource. And 45-533 is the guiding principles for how the department and the associated agencies are supposed to carry out the code. And when a child cannot remain with parents, they're required to give preference to relatives as a placement resource. And although they didn't intervene, these people were materially involved or attempting to be materially involved, and they were relying on the department to help facilitate this. They're hearing from the department that we're looking to place this child with you. They completed an ICPC, a home study. Everything was put in place to allow for this child to move into their home. So the fact that they didn't complete the technicality of intervening, I don't think should deprive them of standing. I think it's the nature and the intent of the juvenile code to provide relatives with this preference. I think also when you look to 43-2106.012, the legislature's intent is clear that they want a broad, expansive definition of who has standing to appeal. I think that's clear in the fact that they've amended it to include custodian or guardian. And with the language that says custodian or guardian shall include but not be limited to, I think that shows an intent that this is supposed to be a broad, expansive definition. And it seems inherently unfair to deny a blood relative the opportunity to be heard on appeal because they weren't advised during the lower court proceedings that they needed to file a motion to intervene.
Your client never was a custodian or guardian, was she?
It depends on how you define it, Your Honor. I mean, he was never allowed to be placed in her home. Did she provide him care during her visits? Sure, of course. Under this court's previous definition of custodian or guardian, she would not qualify, but I believe that definition requires expansion. I believe it's patently unfair, especially in the context of a juvenile case, to have this rigidity in the structure. That says if you didn't intervene or if the department for some reason didn't allow you to have an overnight visitation or to have this child who is your blood relative be placed in your home, that you're not a custodian or guardian as it's defined by the statutes.
What order precisely are you appealing?
It was the review of placement when HHS wanted placement to be moved to Tina Eshelman, the appellant. The state and the guardian ad litem were opposed to that. And that's part of the fundamental problem of this case. There was no counsel present in the trial court to represent the interests of the appellant.
Is that a final appealable order?
It is, Your Honor.
Under what pigeonhole? Help me out.
I believe it is. It affects a substantial right. This is a special proceeding. They are conferred special right based on the nature of the code. As I have already stated, there's a preference that family be looked at first when determining potential placement. I believe that, coupled with the case law, grants my client or makes this a final appealable order. This affects a substantial right of theirs. There's no way that they can have this reviewed of where this child is going to be placed absent having standing to appeal.
As I understand the record, 2 days before your client was located, the parental rights of the parents of this child were terminated.
That's correct.
How does that fit into the analysis?
Well, the state would argue that that's the point in time that all ties to biological kin are severed. I believe that's ill put. I think that the the defining line, if you want to draw a line in the sand, should be when adoption proceedings are instituted. There was nobody stepping forward that was willing and able to adopt Joseph at the time that the parental rights were terminated. The parental rights were terminated entirely prematurely. You'll notice that in the record, the state continuously voiced their disdain for the fact that the department moved them to terminate rights when there was nobody ready to adopt this child. And I don't think that when you have family that's ready, willing, and able to adopt this child, that just because the parental rights were terminated, that that should somehow sever their ability to step in.
One other question for you about the extent or the effect of the ruling that you are urging us to make. Wouldn't it be essentially unlimited as to the relationship to which it would extend? It would apply to fourth cousins?
I believe that it should apply to any blood relatives, Your Honor. If there is a...
So the answer to my question was yes?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Harling, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may approach. You may proceed. Are you sharing your time at all?
I am. We had talked, Mr. Nazisca and I, about me taking 6 minutes, if that's agreeable with the court, and four for Mr. Nazisca. Mr. Nazisca is or was the guardian ad litem for Joseph C. I am the Lincoln County attorney.
And that is an acceptable splitting of time, six and four.
I think the facts of importance in this case are this. June 11th, 2015, I filed a 3A petition saying that Joseph C. was in a dangerous situation. Adjudication followed after having to do a motion in order to publish because we could find neither parent. Through the next 9-10 months, the department used reasonable efforts as best they could, given that both parents absented themselves from the child, from the jurisdiction, at the point of around May of 2016, it became clear that we weren't going to be able to find the parents, that Joseph needed permanency, and so I filed a termination on April 5th, 2016, less than a year after Joseph was placed in care. And for Joseph's permanency, we continued on in that regard. I filed on April 5th, 2016, and an evidentiary hearing was held on June 28th, 2016. It took that long because, once again, we had to publish because neither parent was available. During that period of time, there were two family placements. One was with the maternal grandparents, and their home study was denied due to background checks. They had lengthy criminal histories, and their children, including the mother of Joseph, had previously been a state ward. The child was then moved out of state to Colorado, where Ms. Morris testified at the placement hearing, the counselor, that Joseph was further traumatized. He had a diagnosis of PTSD, of ADHD. He was exhibiting all sorts of problematic behavior. At some point, the maternal aunt and uncle said they can no longer have placement, and Joseph was brought back to the state of Nebraska. We terminated parental rights on June 28, 2016, which I think at that point is the line of demarcation. I think at that point there is no family.
Is your position in that regard inconsistent with 43-533 subparagraph 5? Which seems to talk about adoption and also talk about within that context preference shall be given to relatives for the permanent placement of the child?
I don't think so. One, I think there's case law from the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court that says that there has to be a line of demarcation. There has to be a time when we stop looking for family and look at adoption as the decision that needs to follow. In fact, 43533 subsection 5 says adoption shall be aggressively pursued. And the case law...
But the last sentence in that very same subparagraph talks about, within that context, giving priority to relatives, doesn't it?
It does, but I think the case law says that once you terminate parental rights, and the case law I'm referring to is In Re Interest of S.D. Ditter, or Ditter, and T.L. Ditter, which says that termination of parental rights should be that line. Divesting the tie between the child and the bio family is imperative, that it would defeat the purpose of termination to delay that severing, and during the period after termination and before adoption has to be a period of time when that the vesting or...
What is the object of that, of those propositions?
I think the object is permanency. I think
is the object to make the child available for adoption?
I think the object is to make the child available for adoption. In this case, the Fox family was willing to adopt. We had an adoptive placement, and I think that the proposition that that period of time has to kind of sever the biological relationship, otherwise, during that period of time, we have to keep looking and looking and looking for family members.
Can we get to where you want to go without making a black and white rule that termination completely ends the search for biological relationships?
I think you can, but I think it makes it much more difficult to attain permanency, because if you allow people during that period of time from termination to adoption, if you allow family members to show up at like the last minute and say, hey, I'm interested, then I think you have problems finding permanency.
So if the child becomes available for adoption because of the termination of both parents, right?
Right.
And then what happens to the universe of potential individuals who seek to adopt? Now they're all on equal footing?
Well, I think in this case, the child was in a placement that wanted adoption. And I think in this case, Ms. Morris, Foster Care Review Board, the prior therapist from Colorado, all talked about the fact that that was an appropriate placement. We would have taken a very long period of time to get this child adopted if, in fact, we give appellant the right to do what they're now doing, which is continuing this case on, not allowing adoption to occur.
If a relative hadn't intervened, would your answer be the same?
We wouldn't be here if a relative hadn't intervened. And this relative intervened after the fact, didn't have a home study completed until January of 2017, so that child would have remained in some sort of limbo for that period of time. And then there's no guarantee that his behavior wouldn't deteriorate, his mental health wouldn't deteriorate. He has all the issues of a child who needs stability and structure and placement. With regard to 43533, I did think it was interesting that 4 subsection C says minimize the number of placement changes for children in out-of-home care. That was one of the things that the Foster Care Review Board brought up, that this child did not want to leave the state again. This child had already been, this was the third placement, and the child was in the third placement because two sets of family members could not or would not care for this child and adopt this child.
So is your ultimate argument that reasonable efforts were made?
Reasonable efforts were made for the people they were supposed to be made for, which were mom and dad, the parent.
What about in relationship to the aunt?
Well, I guess I don't think under the statutes you're required to do reasonable efforts with every possible family member that may show up, particularly after termination. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Over.
Thank you.
Mr. Mazzicca, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity, and obviously in the interest of time, I'll kind of cut to the chase. My name is Michael Mazzicca, Mazzicca Law Office in North Platte. I was guardian ad litem in this matter. As guardian ad litem, my responsibility is his best interest, not the family's best interest, his best interest. And as I understand the statutes, we first look at family with regard to placement, unless there's a reason not to. And under the actually lengthy testimony of Stephanie Morse, the therapist, after we started having visits with the Eshelmans, Joseph started wetting the bed, acting out, striking the foster parents, problems at school, not sleeping, all symptoms of PTSD. Also have to remember that Joseph suffered a lot of trauma at the hands of family. Parents, grandparents, and aunt and uncle. The aunt and uncle didn't necessarily need or want to have Joseph remain in their home because of his behavior issues. Went through, he was returned to North Platte, and I'm out of time. So
you may take your 4 minutes.
I appreciate it.
We'll give Mr. Pohlmeier time to respond.
Fair enough. He returned to North Platte so that we could have in a traditional foster placement because we had nowhere else to do it. You have to remember that until after the termination, the appellants had no idea that Joseph existed. But now they want to claim, or apparently want to claim, that the family was so close, but had no idea that he was even there.
Did DHHS move smartly to locate family?
I believe they did. I know that they sent out requests, talked to various people. There was nobody from family that I'm aware of that was ready, willing, and able to come and be a placement for Joseph. One other important aspect is there was some discussion about the time delay in from when the Eshelmans were found until they had their visits. One of the things the department wanted to do was to kind of ease Joseph into it, not just throw him in and overwhelm him with the visits. So what they had asked to do was for the Eshelmans themselves, the aunt and uncle, by themselves, to spend some time with Joseph. They continually showed up with an entire entourage of 8 or 9 people, despite the department's request not to. They also continued to bring toys and gifts for Joseph every single time, despite the department asking them not to do so. They wanted to establish a relationship, not necessarily by Joseph's love. And with I believe he was 8 or 9 years old at the time, that was easy to do. Bring a toy, bring a gift. He would want to go along. But then we saw the behaviors that appeared. Due to the adverse reactions that Joseph had with the family visitation with the Eshelmans, therapist concluded it was in his best interest to remain where he was in the traditional foster placement there in North Platte rather than go to the Eshelmans. That was a placement where...
On a broader scale, what should the interaction be between the statutory preferences and best interests of the child?
As I understand the statute and the case law, there is a preference to go to family, but I believe that it's limited, at least that, I'm sorry, I don't have a citation for you, but I believe it's limited to parents, grandparents, or siblings, not an aunt and uncle, or cousins, or all the other distant relatives that are out there. I think that would open up a floodgate of issues if Joseph is adopted 6 months down the road, fourth cousin twice removed on their mother's side comes in and says, well, I wasn't asked about placement. I want placement with Joseph. He ought to come to me because I'm family. I think that disturbs the intent of the statutes, the intent of what we're trying to do in juvenile court. Provide permanency for these children. As the department puts it, when a child is adopted, a forever home. That's what we're looking for. And the Eshelmans could not, may have been able to do that, but they couldn't follow the rules, the basic ground rules that were requested so that Joseph could process this information and the interactions with this new family. And then one other point before I go is the Eshelmans were there at that placement hearing. They decided that they did not want to reach any common ground. They wanted to let the trial judge decide what to do with Joseph. And that kind of set
the ball. What would be some common ground?
Well, to I think what was discussed, not necessarily that was agreed upon, but what was discussed was maybe a transition from the from placement with the Foxes, where the foster placement, to the Eshelmans. They wanted nothing part of that. They just wanted to have Joseph and take him to Wyoming.
Is what you're telling us in the record?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And that was right before the actual hearing started, or actual testimony was in that placement hearing. So I would ask, I guess I would urge the court to uphold the trial judge's decision in this matter so that Joseph can have some permanence. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? We will give you, how much time do you want, Mr. Pohlmeier?
Whatever you'll
get. I'll give you 2 minutes. How about that?
I would first like to address the state's reference to the Ditter case, the 1982 case. First, that case posturally was much different. This was a grandparent that wanted visitation once adoption proceedings had been initiated, and the court said you don't have standing once adoption has, or once we're moving for adoption, a grandparent doesn't have a right to come in and request visitation. It wasn't a grandparent asking or willing to be the adoptive parent. More importantly in that case was Justin Clinton's dissent. He stated, where an adoption has not taken place and the child is under foster care, the interest of the child may very well be served by granting to grandparents visitation rights. And that's critical. This is a lessened right when the grandparents are asking for visitation rights and not even looking to provide permanency. And Justice Clinton thought that prior to adoption, they should have the right to do that. And I think that goes to, where do we draw the line in the sand? Where do you stop looking at family for potential permanency? And it should not be.
Opposing counsel relies on the therapist's testimony to suggest, as I understand it, that placement with your client would result in detrimental effects to the child. How do you respond to that argument?
The testimony was foundationally deficient. If you look at your holding in the interest of Carly D., the same type of testimony was given. And in this case, because of the posture, when you have the guardian ad litem and the state acting in unison and no counsel that's representing the interests of the appellant in this case, there was nobody to flesh this out on cross-examination. This Stephanie Morris made these observations that these behaviors are occurring, but there was no proof of causation. She didn't view Joseph interacting in the home with the Eshelmans because he wasn't even allowed to. She didn't rule out any other possible variable that might have occurred. What happened to him at school that day? What happened to him the night before? What are the other potential causes for this behavior? And that was the state and the guardian ad litem's proof that placement with family was not in his best interest. That's how they overcame that burden. And the fact that there was nobody there to flush this out on cross-examination and to poke holes in this testimony to prove that there's no foundation for this, it's just merely observations, and she's making this causal link when there's no basis to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will go on to the next.